We are delighted to say that we've once again been selected by the Big Give for this year's Green Match Fund, which means every donation we receive will be doubled. This time around, we're raising funds for our science and research work, and we're hoping to raise £10,000, and the Big Give would match each donation made. Donations must be received via the Big Give website, which will go live on the 18th of April and will remain open for 1 week only until the 25th of April. Every donation will make a difference. We've put a link to the donation page in the show notes.
This week, Bat Chat comes to you from St Mary's Church in the village of Freeby, Leicestershire. First up, though, a shout out to the Essex Bat Group Twitter account, who told us last week how much they're enjoying the show. So give them a follow on Twitter. Their handle is at Essex Bat Group, or hit the link in the show notes. Welcome to Bat Chat. Yes, a warm welcome to Bat Chat's final episode of Series 2. Series 3 is in the making, and there's more information on that at the end of the show. Recorded on location in December, this episode was made before the current lockdown restrictions came into force. We join Nottinghamshire Bat Group member and consultant ecologist Barry Collins at St Mary's Church in the village of Freeby near Melton Mowbray in Leicestershire, where extensive restoration work recently took place to the church, and Barry discusses how the works took place whilst retaining the resident roost of bats.
I'm Barry Collins. I've been involved with the Nottinghamshire Bat Group for probably about 20 years now, something along those lines. But ironically, I do an awful lot of work on Leicestershire churches. And there's a band of them that all contain Natura's bats. And I've been working on those in this area, along with the guys from the Leicestershire and Rutland Bat Group as well, who do an awful lot of work on churches.
And that's as a professional job as well as voluntary, isn't it?
Yes, but it's nearly all. Nowadays, I seem to be so busy that my son does the voluntary work. He does the bat care and the bat rescues, and I seem to be stuck in writing reports and report. But I still keep these churches to myself. They're my special babies. And you could say on this particular church, probably about 60% of the work ended up being voluntary because it became very complicated because it was a huge project.
So, I mean, we're stood here in the entrance to the church, and there's a load of droppings on the floor. The church is fairly empty in terms of the main aisle where the pews would normally be. So what's cracking off here? We've got loads of droppings everywhere. Everything's covered up. What's happened?
Well, this is now a disused church, and it was an active church for many years. I think it finished about 10 years ago. It closed because it was so unsafe. And if you look at the far pillar over there on the north aisle, it's at a weird angle. It's amazing it's standing up. And the church subsided to such an extent that windows started falling out, bits of stonework started falling out, and it became unsafe. In fact, if you stand here and look at the chancel arch, it's just not right. You can see either you've been drinking or the building's not right, and it's not the former. So they abandoned it at that point, and they couldn't raise the funding to fix it. Now, weirdly enough, all of this damage was caused by bad drainage over years and years and years, and it's ended up with the ground settling and this problem occurring. So they ended up closing the church, and that's where the Church's Conservation Trust came in with English Heritage, and they were really proactive, took the church on, and when you look at it today, it's marvellous. It looks in such good condition, and it was dire when I first came in here. There was sections of stained glass windows on the floor where they were trying to, whenever a bit fell out, they were trying to put it together on the floor. There was droppings everywhere. So yeah, it was amazing, really.
It's now being preserved, like you say. So shall we have a walk around and work out where these bats have been roosting? Do you want to say where they were roosting and what you've done to sort of mitigate, I guess?
Yeah, for me, a lot of the groundwork for me, luckily, was done by the Leicestershire and Rutland Bat Group, and Jenny Harris and Neil Hughes, in particular, did a lot of work on this church. They'd already, with a few of the members from the group, identified a lot of the access points into the church, but hadn't had much access inside, because it's difficult to get a key to get in, because it's such a remote village. I think the keyholder's a farmer somewhere down the village. But when we came in, what we quickly established is what you tend to find a lot in these Leicestershire churches is that the bats are roosting in the south aisle, and they're roosting in a gap where the south aisle joins onto the nave, and in particular behind the heavy timber boards that you can see, and the main supporting beam that you see running along the length there. When you go up behind that feature, which you might be able to see with a torch in a minute, whilst it's lovely and pointed below, when it's above, it's hollow stonework. If you stand back against that wall, I can show you on this particular one, whilst keeping my social distance. So you can kind of see that the stonework's not pointed, and there's great big gaps in it, great big holes in it. And so the bats are roosting in those holes as well as behind the timber. And the roof frame's really simple and basic on this particular church. Sometimes you get them as a sandwich where there's one layer on top of another, which is largely done to reduce noise. But all this is these rafters, these sarking planks across. There's like a horsehair type material, like a membrane, and then the lead's sat flat on top. So there's no roosting potential on the underside of the roof. It's all in those gaps there and where those main beams join into the wall. And they roost in three locations on the south aisle.
The mitigation work you've been doing hasn't been because there's a conflict between parishioners in this case. It's just because the building needed repairing to stop it from falling down then.
Yes. Yeah, this was before the Bats in Churches project started. This was we've been working on it. Originally, we got it all ready to go in 2008, and they lost the funding stream. They were absolutely devastated because it was in a really bad state at that point. And they gave up the church, and the Church Conservation Trust took it on. 2014, we got ready to go with it, and we were ready for the September to hit it. And then there were so many delays on the funding that this work actually started in here in March. And there's £500,000 worth of work in here at a time when the bats were here having their babies. So to say it was nervous breakdown material. And what that work involved, Steve, was the whole of the nave was filled with birdcage scaffold. So you imagine you've got like scaffold from floor to base. Whilst the bats are present, the bats had moved in at this point. They come early. They don't comply with a May to September, you know. And I knew that the bats could cope with the birdcage scaffold because we put some up in November down the road at Coaston when that was done, and the bats were still there. In fact, they were there on Christmas Day in the maternity colony, in the same maternity roost. And I spent ages fixing plastic to the scaffold to try and stop the bats hitting it. And then I watched them one night, and they just literally, as if it wasn't there, worked their way through it, as you'd expect for a woodland animal, I guess. Yeah. Worked their way through to their access point and left. So I was confident that they would do that here. The only thing I was worried about was the noise of the scaffolding. So we advised them that if they made a noise, they would have to stop work and go away. What I basically said was if a bat was disturbed and a bat started flying, they had to pack up for the day. And that meant they would lose money. So they put it up really quietly.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's quite a lot of drop-ins there, even though the work's been done. What are the species here and in what sort of numbers?
Sorry, yeah, it's Natras. And it's a Natras maternity roost, and it varies. There's a few pipistrelles, common pipistrelles in. But it varies on numbers, somewhere around sort of 35 up to 70. Last year, there was only 40-odd bats in here. 2018, there was 70. And I said they monitor it every year for the MBMP. So to add to the stress of this keeping the bats, because the bats roost here, then they fly through the nave. I'm pointing now, which is no use. But they fly through the south aisle, through the nave, and out a window in the chancel where there was a missing window. That's one of the points. The others are quite simple ones in the south aisle. So we had to keep those open. But once we got over that stress that they were coping with the scaffolding being here and the work on the rest of the structure, the problem then was the fact the bats didn't come back. So they arrived for the first MBMP survey, and they came into the church because the church was open, and it was full of scaffolding and sheets, and not. They went outside to do the emergency, and there wasn't a single bat. So at that point, luckily I wasn't here, the bat group were going to lynch me, undoubtedly. And so what we started then doing was surreptitiously popping over a few days after that just to double check, because we couldn't figure out why they hadn't come back. And then when they actually came back, there were 70 odd in here, and it ended up being one of the biggest years whilst the work was ongoing. And the work was, you know, really invasive in a lot of ways, because the walls had to be pinned together.
Now, lots of you have seen me in branded T-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store. The link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year. So we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes. So, I mean, in terms of the work that's been done, have any of the actual roost sites themselves been worked on? Have they been left alone whilst the scaffolding was up?
The day roosting areas, or root places where individual bats are roosting, were potentially impacted. Now, one of the things that had to be done here was, there were several ways they were going to deal with it. And what they did in the end was they drilled with a diamond drill right through from one end of the church wall to the other, and pumped these resin and tie bars in that act as anchors. And they hold the thing together. So it's actually knitted together. And in the odd place, you can see a little bit of light mortar where they were drilled out. There was a risk, in particular, when I was going to start in the autumn, which I wanted to do to avoid the maternity colony, of hitting hibernating bats. Because these drills are really quiet and there's hardly any vibration. It's not what you imagine at all. You imagine that there's going to be a hammer drill going and bats flying everywhere and babies falling out. And it was incredible to watch how quiet it was. But fortunately, they had plenty of time to get out of the way because they were active at that time. So we didn't have any dead bats at all found. And most of the work was in these sort of areas. But we categorised the church into features, so we took the specification and we had a group list of work in red that they couldn't do whilst the colony was here. And all of that was in this south aisle, including standing on the roof above where they roost, because they could potentially go underneath where the lead meets the nave. It often folds up and there's a little V underneath that's lovely and warm, and they get into that little space and they could kill them by treading on them when they're putting the scaffold in. So we banned all work in this area. There was no tea room inside. There was no access apart from to work. The door had to be kept closed to try and maintain the temperatures at a stable level. And then we had other areas that they did work on. But because of the late start, a lot of the work that I didn't want to do while the bats were here, such as taking the windows out and managing and repairing all the windows, such as putting the birdcage scaffold in, we had to do in the end because the project was 6 months late starting. Yeah. And they were at risk of losing the... When I told them that they were going to have to wait till October, that was quite an interesting email chain. So we just went, you know what, I think we can work with this, and the bats could work with it, and they have worked with it.
So an awful lot of work and a lot of money and delays to keep the bats here. Is it all worth it?
I think so, because in this part of Leicestershire, we don't really find these naturalist bats in buildings. They're all in these churches. And potentially, maybe once upon a time they were in the barns, but all the barns are lovely houses now. You know, most of the barns have got no agricultural function. And I'm currently working on one, for example, up in northeast of Yorkshire. And it's a beautiful barn there, but they can't fit tractors in them anymore. Yeah. So they're knocking it down, you know. And these are the places where these animals would have lived. And they've been forced, I guess, to be restricted to places like these churches. I mean, I suspect, Steve, that they were roosting in these churches, in this church, from the soon after it was built. Mm. You know, and they've been here ever since. And the mess that you see now is because it's generated over a whole season. But normally, you know, when the churches were really active, when the villages were busy, full of farm labourers, the churches would have been used two or three times a week. There'd have been loads of cleaners, loads of volunteers. The churches would have been full of people. So the bats have really been living in this church since it was built. And to exclude them from here is something I really would struggle with. And I really do struggle with that mentally with the other work that I've been doing on the Bats and Churches project. You know, the risk we take of losing the colony from here. Yes, they might move off to a house down the road, but they're not safe when they're in a house because of the household rules. At the moment, that no laws have been passed for churches, and therefore they're protected while they're in these places. And I'd kind of like to keep them in there.
So, I mean, you mentioned the pressures that bats are getting from barn conversions and other agricultural building conversions. Do you think that there should be something put into the planning system to say that those buildings, you know, have to have bat mitigation built in when they do get converted?
It's interesting one that. I've recently been to a village in Oxfordshire where they, even if they've got bats or not, they have to put boxes into the structure, actually into the structure. And I was quite impressed with that. I kind of like to think that we would do that. I mean, I don't know your experience, but ours is that we can build these amazing bat houses and they don't always work. Mm. And largely they don't work. But I think it's because they've got somewhere else. And sooner or later, when they've got nowhere else, those features have got to be useful. We've built too many really good bat houses in really good locations on spots where they forage, and we've filled them with their droppings and painted the front with a mixture of their droppings and urine and all this sort of stuff, and it hasn't worked. And I think it's because they've got somewhere else at the moment. So I think we do need to sort of build long-term for them. But agriculture, that's a difficult one, because modern agricultural sheds are huge. You know, they're huge steel structures. We're never going to get them to build wooden and stone structures like this one. So let's hope we can keep them in the churches and reduce the impact of them to something that's manageable is what I would like to, the position I would like to get to with the other work we're doing on bats in churches.
We mentioned the droppings there and, you know, people back in the day would have had loads of cleaning work to keep these clean. What's your experience with other churches which have got active parishioners in and the conflict there between the mess that bats make or the noise that bats make and the parishioners themselves and the use of a church?
It's very variable, you know, and it's rarely positive, I'm sad to say, but it is variable, and sometimes it is positive. I mean, Tattershall Church, where we're working as well at the moment, you couldn't have a more positive impact. And the bats cause so much work. So it's not all... They don't love everything about the bats, but they love having the bats. Yeah. They just don't love having to clean up after them. And the attention that they're getting through the Bats in Churches project is fantastic, and it is working. You know, so a lot of the churches I go to, there's a dwindling congregation. They're getting older. They're getting frailer. I mean, when you came in this church earlier, I was sweeping up some of these droppings. Well, some people, that's a struggle for them to sweep a church this size. And they might, you know, when you take some of the churches around this neck of the woods, they might have a congregation of 10 people. You know, it's always down to the same person to sweep them up. So they can get upset about it. And they get upset about it when we put all the constraints in, you know, like when we say, well, you've got to have a licence and it's going to take 2 months for us to get you a licence and it's going to cost twice as much as what it costs us to survey to get that licence. It does bother them. And I've had people actually pull out of the funding from the village and they make a point of telling me who's pulled out the funding because of he's not going to spend the money on the bats. But when you work on them positively, like at Coaston Church, you can get really positive results. So Coaston and Tattershall are opposites. And it varies on the people, Steve. You know, you can have... There's one church up the road that I shall not say where it is, but it's not very far away, where... They've been complaining about a roost of about 15 pipistrelles for the years and the mess that they make. And then 10 miles away, there's another church that's got about 30 long-eared bats in with at least 10 times the mess. And the lovely old fella who looks after it, I went and did a survey there and he said to me, he says, well, at least we haven't got the problem they've got up there. So a lot of it is as well as the perception of the people. You know, some of the people really are anti-bats and we've got to do everything we can to try to get them to live with the bats and like the bats, because legislation isn't going to do it.
So what are those sorts of things that you're doing to get them on side and keep their bats, I guess?
I think identifying when you get positive people and working with those people, and that's what we're doing at Coaston at the moment. So at the moment at Coaston, what we're doing, we've got a very similar problem here as we've got here, with droppings all falling down in the south aisle, which is ironically where the door always is and the font always is. So when you baptise your baby, you've got droppings floating in the water. You know, it don't go down too well. So, and what we're doing there is they've got so tired of cleaning up this mess. They used to put sheets down to catch all the droppings, but they've got so old they can't pick the sheets up because they've got so many droppings on them. And when they pick them up, all the droppings spill over the sides. So we're going to put catch trays up at the roof, mesh ones this year, temporary ones, on a pulley system. And we're going to put them up about, we're going to judge it by how the bats land and go into the roost, how high we have them. And we're going to put those in the key roost locations all the way down the aisle and then close off the other bits. So all the droppings go into a basket and then we can empty them once a year. And that's the plan. Now, one of the trade-offs from that is we've got to do a training course for the bat group in there because they want to get some community use out of the church. They've got a small congregation. So we've got to commit to that. And I think the bats in churches training for volunteer bat wardens will be in that church, actually inside that church, with that maternity colony that lived through an entire winter of builders. So, yeah.
And I mean, natterers are here, and you've mentioned long ears and pipistrelles. What other species of bats would you use churches then?
Well, a variety in this neck of the woods. I mean, I think all species of bats will use churches. I've never found noctules in churches, but I know people who've had them in churches. And I think it can get variable where you are in the country. So, for example, in this neck of the woods, we rarely get bats in the towers. Sometimes we get them in the silencing room between the bells and the ringers, you know, where they'll put the clock winding mechanism in that room. Whereas in Essex, they're commonly found, I understand, in church towers. So it's quite variable. But in this area, apart from the huge amount of natterers roosts that there are in these churches, and research suggests that they're not connected because there's one down the road that's only 3 miles down the road. You'd assume that these bats and those bats interact at some point. But the research that was done under the Bats in Churches contract originally suggests that they don't mix. They're not actually a same colony. I mean, obviously the males will move about. But we've got up the road, we've got a large roost of Dorbenton's bats, and that's in a very active church, and they do cause a lot of problems. There's about 300 Dorbenton's up there. Not far from there, we've got a couple of roosts with long-eared maternity roosts in. The soprano roosts are always a bit of a killer in the churches because they're a bit smelly as a bat, as you know, and they roost in big numbers, so you get even more droppings. And they also roost in isolated, localised areas, so you tend to get big aggregations, whereas these are roosting in three or four places along here.
And when you say big numbers, like what's the larger end of a roost then?
Well, Tattershall's got 800-odd bats in, 800, I think it's 800 pipistrelles, and then it's got about 200 Dorbentons, up to 200. I think I might have it as 800 in total. But these natterers roosts all are around somewhere between 30 to 80 in this area. The pipistrelle roost, there's no massive ones in my group of churches, but there's a big one that Matt Cook's working with on the other side of Leicestershire. I think that's a good couple of hundred that's in there. I mean, obviously the roosts can go to huge. I mean, I've worked on properties with 400 regularly sopranos. So, you know, and they were quite difficult to deal with because of the smell issues. But yeah. So all of the species of bats that you would find in this area, I don't think we've found a barbastella in a church yet. Yes. But all of this, they're moving with global warming, I'm sure of it. But all of the bats you would kind of find in this area, apart from your woodland species, and you would find in churches. But only two species of that have been found in this church here.
And how's it all tying in with the Bats in Churches project then, that joint conservation project between Bat Conservation Trust, the Church of England and CCT and all those stakeholders? How many churches are involved in that project? Are you doing any work? How's that project going?
Yeah, well, that's really moved on, and there's some really innovative stuff going on in that area, and you'd have to speak to some of those guys to get the detail on it. But there's one of the churches in Warwickshire where they're putting an attic space in a church. Well, you know, I remember we had a big meeting about Stamford-on-Avon Church with English Nature. They tried to get some work going, some mitigation going, 15, 20 years ago. And at that point, we weren't even allowed to put shrouds over monuments, you know, and now we're moving forward to put attic spaces in places and things like that. I think that these organisations are now starting to work under this project in a really positive way. You know, you've got to bear in mind, we love bats. So as soon as somebody does something that is detrimental to the bats, we don't like those people. So, and likewise, people love historic buildings. And when our bats poo all over them, they don't like bats and they don't like the people that love bats. So, and we've all got to sit around a table and come out with objectives that satisfy everybody. So, for example, at Tattershall, the first year's project has all been spent on reducing the drop-ins impact on people areas, people, places where people sit to eat and drink cups of tea, the kitchen areas, where the largest sort of people congregation areas are now clear of bats. They're roosting elsewhere in the church. But the next big problem is in the North Transept, which is where all the historic issues are. Well, as a bat worker, you kind of think, well, just put a sheet over them, they'll be fine. But of course, as far as the historic people are concerned, that's a priority. So that's what we're working on this year. And that's how this project's done. It's brought people together where we were all those years at Stamford-on-Avon. We were at loggerheads with each other. In fact, I couldn't see a solution while I was stood there in the church, apart from everybody put a pair of boxing gloves on and start fighting, really. But yeah. So yeah, it's really positive now. And there's a load of churches with a load of different options going in. A lot of people trying things as well that you wouldn't consider, that somebody's come up and they've had an idea and they thought, you know what, I'm going to try something in this area, and it's getting the go-ahead and they're doing it. So, yeah, fingers crossed we find these solutions. Hopefully, not too many colonies will be badly impacted by those solutions, because undoubtedly some of these ideas we try will result in these bats leaving this area and going somewhere else. Now, if it's somewhere like Tattershall, to say to the people, the bats don't like the fact that we've moved them out of the kitchen area, we'd like to put them back again, it is going to be very difficult in a few years' time. So fortunately there, we've managed to come to a solution that the bats are happy with and that we're happy with.
One thing I've noticed in my line of work, I've noticed that when we do get church projects and we go to do the surveys, it's usually around making churches more of a community building. You know, they're not just there for worship, they're there for school nursery groups, yeah. Or they want to put in kitchens and tea rooms. Have you found the same sort of thing?
Yeah, and they very much seem to be very proactive churches that are working in that way as well. And I guess a lot of the ones that are in the Bats in Churches project are as well, because you had to be proactive and put your name forward and push to get yourself in and on the lists that they're on. And you're right, we've been to some great churches, like this one, for example. You know, all the pews have gone. It's a big open space. They can have events in here. You know, the Churches Conservation Trust lets the community, in fact, I think the community have to use it for a set number of nights or days a year, including for worship. So it is the way forward, I think, to make them into a community hub. But in doing that, we've also got to try and manage the bat situation, you know, and that does mean that we have to, some way, change these structures. Because ultimately, Steve, what we've done here is when you look above you, we've gone out there into the forests and we've cut down all the bats' homes and we've planed them up and we brought them in here and we've stuck them in here, and lo and behold, the bats have moved back in here because this is their homes. So we have to try and do something so they can live together, really.
And how did you get so heavily involved with churches?
I kind of stumbled into it. I started doing some churches, but what happened was I started doing some doctoral research into the success of mitigation. And at the time, I went to DEFRA and I was going to look at the success of EPS licence mitigation. But at the time, I crunched and crashed into data protection laws. And at that time, just as I was about to launch, DEFRA said, no, you can't have access to any records, nothing. So I got no roosts, I got nothing. So of course, in those days, the good old guys at English Nature were there. We didn't always call them good old guys in those days. But now they were saints. They were there and they said, yeah, of course you can have access to our roost records. And that meant churches. So I ended up with properties that were being re-roofed, properties that were being timber treated, and churches. So I ended up working on about, across the country, probably about 60 different churches, and looking at the effect of re-roofing and timber treatment and whether it had affected the bats And I found that there was no significant impact. There was localised impacts that the back groups would tell you about, but long term there was no significant impact from all these quite serious bits of work. The things that were obviously, I'm excluding from that, are things like exclusion, where somebody's deliberately blocked them out.
Yeah.
And then from that, I kind of ended up sort of getting interested, and I did some presentations on it. So then the Leicestershire and Rutland back group pushed for me to get involved in one of their churches. I can't remember which one it was now. I think it might have been Gopi Marwood. And then from there, the architects then said, well, this guy's working with church, you know, and it went on and on and on. So, and I'm pleased to say that from that, I started to get a lot of churches to work on. And I've worked on, I don't know, probably well over 100 churches in my time now. But that's nothing in comparison to some of the pioneers of church conservation work, like in Essex. The Jigginses in Essex, I think they've done something like 400 churches. And Philip Parker over in the east of England, I think he lives in a church, and or churches. I think he's well over double what I've looked at. But yeah, I've looked at a lot of churches. I've seen a lot of roosts. The use of night vision technology that I blagged off other people when it first came out in really crude formats has allowed me to see what the bats are doing inside these churches and develop these mitigation schemes, whereas all bar one church in my own county that's monitored by my own back group have been successful. But my own Bramcote Towers roost, unfortunately, I've lost the roost somehow and I don't quite know how. But the rest of them, yeah, they've done all right.
And they're quite difficult to survey. You mentioned night vision kit there. One of the things that quite a lot of people say in back groups is that churches require a bit of knowledge about. It's not just one of those where you rock up outside and count the bats come out. They're a bit more complicated than that, aren't they?
I think the problem is the fact that you need to be able to see, and that's going to be something that will come. The really simple structures, really, people do get quite worried about them, and they're very simple structures. They're just like big pieces of Lego all stuck together. You know, they're not complicated, but the way that the bats use them can be. So, for example, in this church, you've got a rooster exit out of a window where a glass pane fell out in the chancel that somehow they've found and they use. Now, where I've fitted these in other churches, they won't use them, but which is weird. They go out of a settlement crack in the west end of the south aisle, and they go out over the top of this wall that we're leaning against on the south aisle wall. They go out over the top, out the rafter ends. Now, there's a sort of like a group of features that bats tend to use to get in and out of churches, typically. There's always going to be a percentage who do something really bizarre. So if I wrote a book about it, somebody would criticise me because I haven't mentioned the fact that they go in the gutter spout and crawl along underneath the lead gutter, which I have happens down the road at Coaston. They go about a metre. But there is, quite simple, but the problem is you have to be able to see them. And like the natteries, they'll start to come out quite soon after the pipistrelles. You know, we used to think you have to hang around for 2 hours for them to come out. And if you wait for 2 hours, all you'll get is cold outside this church. But by the time they have come out, Steve, it's dark and you can't see them coming out the windows because you can't see them against the... And it tends to make people think that it's difficult to survey for. Plus, nobody wants to stand on that north corner of the church because nothing's happening. There's possibly not even anything coming past you. Everybody wants to stand on this south side of the church where the bats are pouring out. So you have to have people who are prepared to stand and look in the cruddy bits. But I think the one thing that's come out of the Bats in Churches collaboration is the fact that we've, under the new class licence for Bats in Churches, you have to have somebody inside with monitoring, with vision equipment. And I think in due course it'll be thermal imaging, but at the moment it's not, it's infrared. And with that, we can see what's happening. You know, we can see who's going where and what's happening.
So if there are listeners out there who are thinking, oh, I've got a church down the road from me, I want to go and see if there's bats in there, what's the best plan of action for them? And where, you know, in a minute we can have a look around and you can point out where bats might be once they've got access. What's the best plan of action for them?
The key thing to do is to get in touch with the church and find out who the church warden is and see if you can get access into the church, because so many of them are locked now. You turn up at the door and you go rattle the door and you can't get in. So, and if you can't get in, you can't really get an idea of what's happening. So once you've had a word with him, you need to find out when the church is cleaned, because the droppings are the evidence. If there's a maternity of colony of bats in a building and you leave that building empty for 3 years, you don't need to do an emergency survey. You can tell there's a maternity colony in that that building or not. And it's likewise with the church, just in a period of 5 days, because there's nothing protecting the droppings falling out of that roof onto that floor. That gives you the chance to get in and see if there's a lot of droppings. You'll even find small numbers of droppings. And what I tend to do is I come in a church and I go up to the top corner and I just work my way down systematically. I use the beam of my torch and I just scan the south aisle, then I scan the north aisle, then I scan the nave, and then I scan the chancel. And I tend to leave the best back bit of that church to last, otherwise you'll rush the rest and to get to see the bit where all the bats you think are going to be.
Yeah.
And just work your way through it systematically. You'll find out where they're roosting. But the critical thing in churches is how they get in and out. Now, like us, they often use the door. If they don't use the door, then you have to start working it down. And that's where bat groups themselves can come in, because they can have people stood all around the church and they'll tag where the bats are coming out. When you're on your own, you know, we used to survey on our own as well. You know, years ago, we surveyed buildings on your own. When you're on your own, it's quite hard to find where they're coming in and out.
So shall we have a look around and you can point out where the droppings are in here and where there would be in other churches?
So on this one here, on this particular, in this aisle, in the south aisle, we've got bats roosting in those holes in the stonework up at the top that we looked at earlier. So this is the main roost area. We get some pipistrelles roosting up under this, the end rafter. They often roost between the end rafter and the walls and anywhere really where there's a joint, where a piece of timber meets a piece of stone or two pieces of stone meet together, there's a joint, and it's like a Kent bat box really, in a large scale. So you often get a pipistrelle up here, and there may even be one up here now because there's some droppings, although they're natural droppings by the look of it. But they tend to roost up this gap here. I don't see any here at the moment, Steve. So I'm surprised how few dead bats there are in here as well, considering there's a maternity roost in here. At this end is where the main entrance, the emergence points are. But what I always do when I come into church as well is look at the back of the door. And the back of the door will tell you if there's any bats using the doors before you even shut it. We've seen them go in and out through where the lock mechanism goes because there's a gap. And I've even heard them going through these huge key. I've heard stories of them going underneath the door as well, which I've never seen that, but it doesn't surprise me. This is a centre here that you can see with all these droppings. There's a roost area above here, but in this corner, there's a big settlement crack that was left because it was the main access point, and they go in and out of this area here as well. And then when you come into the nave on this church, there wasn't really a lot in this church in the nave. As I said earlier, when I was sweeping up, there was a large deposition over on this main roof beam on the nave here below it. There was a large deposition of droppings there, suggesting there was some roosting there. And I don't really remember that when we were doing work. Yeah. But there's huge cracks in the chancel arch, in the wall, you know, the nave there, above the chancel arch, that were all pinned together. They were definitely roosting in those. The pipistrelles were. And what we had here, we monitored these with cameras, night vision cameras, from the birdcage scaffold that was right in the top there. So, junctions, you've got a junction of the roof covering with the nave gable and where it meets the tower, always common places in the corners where they'll roost. And of course the rafter ends, where the rafters go out over the building, they'll focus on those as well. These particular areas, these will go straight out. I often wonder, sometimes the hardest place to find bats when they're coming in and out of churches is churches that have got castellated walls or parapet walls, you know, where there's like a stone edge on top of the roof going all the way around, like a castle has. And they're the ones where they really find the innovative ways of getting into the church.
I've just done one of those and I had pipistrelles re-entering. They landed on the lead gutter and then were crawling through the gutter bits and then under the lead that way.
Well, I've only ever seen that twice. And the first time I thought they were roosting. I couldn't figure out how they were getting in and out. Years ago that was. And it was only when I had a maternity roost going in and out of them that I realised what you've seen is, so it's obviously clearly more common than what you think that. Well, yeah, the lead guttering that's above the nave here, that sits in a stone trough effectively on a parapet wall. And what they do is they line it with timber and then they put the lead in. And over time, damp gets in there and the timber rots and you get a gap. So then the bat goes in through the bottom of the, or the top of the spout that comes out, and they crawl under that lead form, and they, until the first, as soon as they find a gap that comes into the church through the rafter ends. And that's how they get into Coaston down there. And they can travel sort of 2 metres. One of the cleverest guys I once heard talking about bats and the way they use roosts says that, you know, like basically if they use a feature, they will always use that feature. And that was shown on that church, because instead of having to crawl 2 metres along the top of the wall and come out through a gap in a rafter, I made a hole straight through from the spout. God, I thought it would be easy. I left the original one and I made a new one. And they didn't use the new one for about 2 years. Yeah. They walked straight past it, which is bizarre, because they would be able to smell everybody in the church. And that's where you need to, the knowledge that you've just mentioned. Otherwise, you, on a church like Coaston, you would have blocked all the bats out. There wouldn't be any in there because there's no other accesses.
And then looking towards the eastern end, so the roosting area is similar to what we've just looked at in the nave. It's all those joints where the wall meets the wooden rafters.
Yeah, that's right. It's always where there's a joint. And sometimes, of course, you've got mortise joints in these timbers. And sometimes you don't even see those mortise joints, you know. They can be above. So as much as I've said on the wall where it's all very decorative where it can be seen, above where it can be seen, it can be quite rough. Yeah. And there can be some big holes going in. Some big mortises that they can get into, almost like a big line of bats in a tube, like a tube of Smarties or something like that, you know, where the bats are lined up down an alley, decide who's getting out. The other thing they did here that you can see is the old-fashioned thing, which is the tie beams. They put these tie beams across in order to hold the church together. When you look at it, it's quite amazing when you think what they did. And when you look at that pillar there, I mean, the angle of it's incredible, isn't it? It's amazing the church didn't fall over.
I mean, we're looking at it, and to say it's not straight is an understatement. It's got a several degree lean out.
I couldn't say what degree, because I wasn't that good at maths. But yeah, I wouldn't, if it was my house, if I was buying a house, I might not buy this one. But yeah, and this is all pinned together now with invisible stitching, effectively.
Yeah. And do you think the future of bats and churches is looking better than it was, or is there still a lot of work to do?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think the issue with churches is a difficult one, Steve, because they have to have a function in the community in order to survive. I think in a lot of the commuter belt in these villages, there should be church taxes. You know, I live in a village. I'm lucky enough to live on the outskirts of a village, and we've got a little church, and I'd be quite happy to pay some taxes towards keeping that church. I'm not a regular churchgoer, but you know, I want my kids to get married there, and I kind of hope they'll dig a hole and put me in it one day. Not too soon, I hope. But, and like a lot of people do, you know, I think we need to keep them for that function. You know, the community side of the churches is really important. And I think that's also, you know, what the religious function gives. It gives so much kindness and caring to the community to be part of a church. But yeah, so what's the future? I hope that this legislation doesn't get put through where they can exclude bats from churches. I can't see how it will, but I can also see in this world that those sort of things could just be taken, a decision could be taken, and that would be devastating for bats, I think. For naturalist bats in this region, I don't know what that would do to the population. So we have to find ways of bats and people living together, but we have to go out of our way and, you know, praise the Lord for the lottery funding and the Church's Conservation Trust, really, project managing it, because otherwise, you know, this church wouldn't be here. Somebody would have bought this for development. Yeah. This would have been a house, like there's another one in Leicestershire, because it would have gone for nothing in the end. Who wants a building that's literally falling down? You know, it's on the at-risk register as well. As soon as you buy it, you've got the council giving you instructions as to what you've got to spend on it. It's great to see it now, Steve. You know, when you saw it then, and you think that there was £500,000 worth of work, and it just to keep this structure. There's nothing in there. There's no fancy kitchens or anything like that. It's just the structure that was spent on. £500,000 worth of work. Is it worth it? I kind of think so.
Great stuff. Barry Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barry Collins from Nottinghamshire Bat Group there, and my thanks to Barry for taking time out of his day to speak with me. Are you willing to explore a local church this summer for evidence of bats? If so, the Bats in Churches project mentioned there by Barry needs you. You can help them to better understand how bats are using churches across England by taking part in one of their two surveys, Church Bat Detectives and the National Bats in Churches Study. You can take part in the surveys, whether this is your 100th BATS survey or your first. Just head to their website to find out how to get involved, batsinchurches.org.uk, and as always, the link is in the show notes. We really hope you've enjoyed the bat conservation stories being told in this podcast. Bats are magical but misunderstood mammals, and here at the Bat Conservation Trust we have a vision of a world rich in wildlife where bats and people thrive together. We know that conservation action to protect and conserve bats is having a positive impact on bat populations in the UK. We would not be able to continue our work to protect bats and their habitats without your contribution, so if you can, please donate. We need your support now more than ever. To donate, please head to the link at the bottom of the show notes. Thank you. And that's it for Series 2, but we're delighted to say that Series 3 will be coming to you later in the year. It's looking rather promising that the coming summer may be something that we're more used to, so we hope you all have a fantastic time getting out there and enjoy seeing bats in the night sky. We're looking for participants to share the local bat work taking place up and down the country with the podcast, so if you're working on a great bat project or have a story about the bats in your area to share, drop us an email to the address in the show notes. If you're able, please do leave a review of Bat Chat in your podcast app. Reviews help other people to discover the podcast. With Bat Chat, we're reaching out to lovers of bats all over the world. So if you know someone who's never listened to a podcast before, we'd love it if you could show them how to listen and how to find Bat Chat. If you can share this episode on social media with your friends and followers, our hashtag is Bat Chat. Bat Chat is an original podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust. Our theme music is by Raphael Crooks, and our artwork was designed by Rachel Hudson. The series producer and editor was me, Steve Rowe, and I'd like to say thanks to the communications team at BCT, Joni Nismino and Andrea Correa da Costa, for their fabulous work and support in promoting us on social media and linking to the episodes on the BCT website. And of course, a huge thanks to you guys, our listeners, for your ongoing support of the show. Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that?
We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote Bat Chat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes.